Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is Side 1 of For the Record program number 531, titled Interview with Lucy Commissar About Offshore, and this is being recorded on October 30th of the year 2005. Once again, it is my pleasure and privilege to present to the audience Lucy Commissar, an expert on what is known as offshore. And Lucy, welcome back once again to our airwaves.
Thanks.
Why don't we start by giving the listeners a definition of offshore, and we should probably make a point of distinguishing between offshore, and in particular, we should point out its functional definition as opposed to a mere geographical conception, and also distinguish it from offshoring, a confusion that I made earlier today.
Okay. Offshore refers to financial centers, which originally were set up in places that were actually offshore, that is, in the Channel Islands or in the Caribbean, offshore from the major countries that were using them. But it refers now to places where there are parallel financial systems. They're secret. They're segregated from the traditional banking structures of the same jurisdictions. They're restricted to non-residents. So if you live in Grand Cayman, you cannot use the same secret bank accounts that a non-resident can, and there are more than 4,000 offshore banks that are believed to exist in about 70 offshore locations. Now, they don't have the kind of regulation and supervision of banks that you get onshore. Many times they can be formed, registered, put in the hands of fake directors over the Internet. There's little requirement for disclosure. The bank transactions can go over the Internet. There aren't restrictions on interest rates or any other controls that a government would put on its banks, such as capital reserve to protect the people that have accounts. They're mostly tax-free. Sometimes they're shell banks. They don't even exist in bricks and mortar. They're just in paper. And they are set up to hide the identity of the real owners of accounts. Sometimes the offshore centers allow you and facilitate forming secret companies. They're called international business companies, IBCs, or trusts, or investment funds, or insurance companies. And they also have nominee directors. That is, they're not the real director or owner. They're put in place by the bank or the company that sets up the shell, and it's to hide the true owner. Now, offshoring is a word that is used to describe when a company move some of its business activity to some place. Like, for example, companies will set up a call center in India. So the work of the company for their helpline, for example, their customer service line, is in India. So that's called offshoring, and it's totally different. There's also offshore oil, which has to do with oil that is found in the middle of the ocean or in the sea offshore from any particular company. But those are similar words, but it has nothing to do with offshore bank and corporate secrecy, which is what we're talking about.
Okay, Lucy. You have written several articles for Alternet. These are available on the Internet about some aspects of a corporate scandal that has had some publicity, but that has really not received the scrutiny that it deserves. There has been, in the wake of Enron and WorldCom, a number of moves to reform the corporate structure, and there have been a number of indictments and investigations. And a major insurance company, AIG, eventually fell into the crosshairs of Elliott Spitzer. But you've written a number of things about AIG, and what I'm going to ask you to do for much of the rest of the first side here is to delineate for us some of the things that have been going on with AIG. The company itself has an interesting history and one that overlaps the intelligence community. I wonder if you could tell us about how the old OSS, America's World War II Intelligence Service, overlaps with the development of AIG, and tell us a little bit about Maurice Hank Greenberg and his potential links to the intelligence community as well.
Okay, let's start by understanding the significance of this company. This is the third on Forbes' list of the world's biggest companies after Citigroup and General Electric. So we're not talking about just a very little insurance company. The last figure I have was for 2003, AIG reported a net income of $10 billion It has operations in 130 countries, some 77,000 employees. Okay, when AIG, which means American International Group, when it started, it was linked to the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, which was the forerunner of the CIA. It started out being called Asia Life. It was started by a man named C.V. Starr, Cornelius Starr, and he started his empire in Shanghai in 1919. He served with the OSS in World War II, and the Starr Corporation was located in the same building as the OSS in New York. It provided intelligence on shipping, manufacturing, and industrial bombing targets in Asia and Germany. So this was a close connection from the very beginning. And most of the connection, of course, is by definition secret. But there are a few times when we could see clues to indicate that a relationship continued. For example, it has been written that when Bill Casey became CIA director in the Reagan administration, he wanted Hank Greenberg, by then the president of AIG, to be his deputy. But Greenberg wanted to stay with AIG. After the Ames scandal, Senator Specter of Pennsylvania floated Greenberg's name as a replacement for Woolsey, but the job went to Tenet. So we can see that this was a very trusted individual by the intelligence community.
All righty. Now, AIG itself, again, you've indicated just how big a star this is in the corporate firmament, so to speak. And one of the things that you have done is to lay out not only how powerful it is, but also some of the people that are either on its board of directors or its international advisory board. Tell us about some of the big names that are associated with AIG.
The chair of the AIG International Advisory Board is Henry Kissinger, who is as well connected as you can get politically. The board of directors includes William Cohn, who used to be the U.S. Secretary of Defense. Before that, he was a senator. And Carla Hills, who was U.S. Trade Representative. Richard Holbrooke, who was the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations. Before that, he was Assistant Secretary of State dealing with Asia. So these are very well-connected people, and people connected in a way that deals with very sensitive aspects of American politics. It fits in with Hank Greenberg's profile.
Now, AIG did come into the news recently. Earlier this year, Maurice, quote, Hank, unquote, Greenberg resigned. And what I want you to do, Lucy, is to tell us some of the shenanigans that AIG has been involved in, and in particular, some of the offshore gambits that they've been involved in. And also, explain to us, too, Lucy, don't be shy about talking about some of the ways in which you characteristically have been out front of the pack in covering the AIG story.
Okay. In May this year, New York State Attorney General Spitzer filed a suit against AIG and Greenberg, charging a pattern of fraud through the use of sham transactions that bucked up, bolstered that conglomerate's financial statements. Well, some of those stories have not yet been made public, either at all or in detail, and I've written about both of them for Alternate and also for CorpWatch. The one that has never been published in any corporate media is a very interesting story that has to do with AIG promoting corporate tax evasion. And again, let me say, this has not been reported outside the alternative media. First, let me explain one thing. Captive insurance and what that is. A captive is an insurance company that's owned by the company it insures, and it generally has that company as its only client. Reinsurance is insurance that an insurance company buys so that if it has to pay out a claim, it doesn't take all the risk. Mm-hmm. So you have a captive insurance company, and you have reinsurance, and this is part of how the insurance industry works. I discovered and reported on a case where AIG used a reinsurance company that was secretly owned by its client's CEO to help him evade taxes, and also, by the way, to increase AIG profits in a way that may have cheated the stockholders of the client. And I wrote about this case in Alternet. So let me explain more in detail how this works. Victor Posner, who died in 2002, was a crook known as the original corporate raider. He was famous for engineering hostile takeovers of companies and then looting them. He had a history of corrupt dealings. He owned a Delaware factory called NVF that made Vulcan rubber. He was the CEO of most of the shares, but it was a public company. NVF had a workers' compensation policy with an AIG company. One is required under the law to have workman's compensation, and companies get this from private companies. This AIG company reinsured it with Chesapeake, which was a reinsurance company based in Bermuda, an offshore center where you can't find out who owns anything. Well, it turned out that Chesapeake was owned by Posner. In the early 1990s, a Delaware insurance investigator discovered that NVF, this factory, was paying twice the market rate to AIG for insurance. Well, why would it want to do that? Well, it was because both sides, AIG and Victor Posner, came out ahead. AIG would keep a portion of the inflated premium. It was getting more than it could charge on the market, and it would get a higher premium. Then it would send a part of that to Chesapeake for reinsurance, but that money was owned by a company that was owned by Posner, and he would write off the higher amount that they were paying as a business expense, and then he would get the extra cash in Bermuda tax-free because this reinsurance company wasn't paying anything out. So the money, just figure that suppose it costs $1 million. Really, it costs $1 million to get a policy for workman's compensation. But suppose they're paying $2 million. So suppose that the normal commission was 10%.
Now, let me interrupt you just for a second, Lucy. Now, $2 million, it would normally cost, say, $1 million for a company to insure their workers against injury on the job.
We're taking an example because it depends on how many workers there are.
Oh, sure. But what I'm saying now is, but they're actually, in this case, they're paying $2 million to this Bermuda company.
As an example, I don't know. It may not be it was double, but take that as an example, which was told to me by the insurance investigator. So it may be close to the actual number, but therefore, the percentage commission you get on $2 million is bigger than what you get on $1 million, right? So that AIG is making a bigger profit.
Sure.
It is using part of that extra money to buy reinsurance in Bermuda from Chesapeake, which is actually owned by Posner. But the money is supposed to be for paying out claims. But the way it works, there aren't any claims to be paid off. And Mr. Posner keeps the money in this offshore company called Chesapeake in no tax Bermuda. He's not paying any taxes to the U.S. on this profit. It's a secret profit. So both sides are winning. The losers are the U.S. taxpayers and also the minority shareholders of the rubber company, because their company had to pay off twice the real fee for the workers' compensation. They had to pay $2 million instead of $1 million, so there's $1 million that they're not getting in profits. So they're losing also. The taxpayers are losing, and the minority stockholders are losing. In the early 1990s, a Delaware insurance investigator discovered this. And the reason he discovered it is because Posner was a crook, and the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, had ruled that he could no longer have any role in running a public company, so he couldn't run this Vulcan rubber company anymore. They gave it to a trustee to run, and the trustee sent in various people to look at the books, and the insurance analyst discovered that they were paying twice the market rate to AIG for insurance. And he immediately changed the insurance policy. When I talked to a Delaware insurance regulator who had told them, I talked to the person who did the investigation, and he confirmed all of this. And then I talked to the insurance regulator who had tipped me on to this case, and he said this was not an isolated case with Vulcan Rubber. AIG did that a lot. He said AIG helped companies set up offshore captive reinsurance companies. AIG would then overcharge on insurance and pay reinsurance premiums to the captives, giving the captive owners tax-free offshore income. The Delaware Department of Insurance took no action against the insurer. I called up AIG to ask about this, and the company spokesman, Andrew Silver, said, "We don't have any comment on that." Well, I think it's time for Mr. Spitzer and others to look into this, and the IRS, by the way, because tax evasion is a crime, but this is something that AIG was involved in facilitating. I looked at the AIG website. It says it pioneered the formation of captives almost 60 years ago, and it has management facilities to run the captives in offshore Barbados, Bermuda, Cayman Islands, Gibraltar, Guernsey, the Isle of Man, Luxembourg. Those are all places where corporate and accounting records are secret and taxes are minimal or non-existent. So this is a whole area which has not yet been made public, other than in the articles that I wrote for Altnet. But it's time it was made public. Then there's another case, also quite important. It's been alluded to, but it's never been discussed in great detail in the corporate press. It's been talked about in a couple of very good insurance industry newsletters, but not in the corporate press. This happened in the late 1990s. There were four state insurance companies, New York, Delaware, Pennsylvania, and California. We're aware that AIG was moving debt off its books, that it was using an offshore insurance company that it set up and controlled, but it didn't do anything about it. And what had happened was, even earlier, that the state law requires insurance companies to keep a certain amount of capital available to pay out their claims. If you spend all your money in a way that you can't get it back easily, and if you have claims, how are you going to pay them out? But if you have reinsurance, I mean, that would prevent you from having investments that were not liquid, that you could not immediately turn back into cash. If you have reinsurance, the amount that you have to keep available can be lower because the reinsurer would pay out some of the claims, but the reinsurer has to be an independent company. There's not a reduction of risk if it's just moved to another division of the same company. So what happened was, in the mid-1980s, two of the AIG reinsurers failed. Now AIG was going to have a higher level of debt on his books because it would have to pay out the claims itself, and it would be able, therefore, to invest less money under the law. So Hank Greenberg decided to set up a phony reinsurance company to move his bad debts off the AIG books. This was called Coral Re. It was set up in Barbados, where the capital requirements and the regulation were minimal, and where American regulators couldn't find out that AIG was really running this company, and also they could move the money out of the reach of U.S. taxes. This scam was arranged with the help of Goldman Sachs, which was then headed by Robert Rubin, who would become President Clinton's Treasury Secretary, and now is the chairman of the Executive Committee of Citigroup. It got some very high-level corporate executives to front for this supposedly independent company. There's some interesting documentation that show just what happened. I have a confidential memo by Goldman Sachs which told why the company was formed. It says, quote, AIG's interest in creating the company is to create a reinsurance facility which will permit its U.S. companies to write more U.S. premiums. For a U.S. domiciled company, a high level of surplus is required to support insurance premiums in accordance with U.S. statutory requirements. The statutory requirements in Barbados are less restrictive.
I love the language there. They're less restrictive. Go ahead, Lucy.
So they're saying AIG wants to make this company because it doesn't want to abide by the U.S. laws, and it doesn't like the U.S. regulations. So clearly, it says AIG's interest in creating the company. It's an AIG company. Well, the people who got this memo were corporate executives from some big companies. They were the serving or the former chairman of Reynolds Metals, Kraft, Itel, Menon Company, Morton Thiokol, some others. In exchange for their names to be the investors, they were guaranteed a return of about $25,000 per share in the first year and $45,000 in each other year. And when did you ever buy a stock when you were actually guaranteed a return? That's pretty interesting. Seems more like a loan to me. They didn't have to put up any money. They got financing from the Sanwa Bank of Chicago, which was secured by Coral Reef shares. And they got a guarantee of enough dividends from Coral Reef to cover the interest. Well, this is a deal you can't refuse. And they could sell the shares whenever they chose, and they would have a guaranteed buyer. This was a no-lose so-called investment. Another part of the investment was offered to and taken up by the Arkansas Finance and Development Authority. This was a company supposedly to develop housing in Arkansas. It was headed by a man who went to work in the Clinton White House. State law banned the Arkansas Finance and Development Authority from buying stocks. How could this government agency, and Clinton was then the governor of Arkansas, why was it buying stocks? Clinton, by the way, would make Rubin his Treasury Secretary. There's lots of interlocking networks here. So the company was not a legitimately independent business. There was no money at risk. The board of directors never made a decision. Coral Reef had no offices. It was managed by the American International Management Company, a subsidiary of none other than AIG. So eventually the whole scheme unraveled. In the early 90s, a Delaware examiner smelled a rat. AIG refused for years to provide any documents to the examiners, so it took them a while to nail the connection. And when they finally supplied the financial papers of Coral Reef, the regulator could not believe it. He told me the books were cooked. The books were definitely cooked. But the regulators in charge in Delaware, Pennsylvania, New York, and California, who all investigated, were cowards. And they said in 1996, AIG owned Coral Reef. There was no transfer of risk. They didn't act to punish AIG. They just said, stop doing what you're doing. By then, AIG had found some other reinsurance companies to which to move the policy. It didn't need Coral Reef anymore. But it learned that if you were powerful politically, you don't have to worry about whether or not state regulators will enforce the law, because they won't. Now, the other point that's interesting, if Coral Reef was an AIG affiliate, it would have to pay taxes on its income. If it was independent, the money came tax-free. Of course, it was clear it was an AIG affiliate.
Mm-hmm.
IRS didn't have the guts to go after them either. And I spoke to an AIG spokesman, Andrew Silver. He denied everything the insurance commissioners had found. He said AIG was not involved in the offer and sale of Coral Reef shares. That was done by Goldman Sachs, which approached investors with which it had relationships. AIG did not control or have an equity interest in Coral Reef. That, of course, is completely untrue, which you can see from the secret memo that Goldman Sachs put out. And Goldman Sachs would not talk to me about its role in setting up Coral Reef. So this is an example of how a major corporation, a huge corporation, cooks the books, cheats on taxes, helps facilitate the cheating of investors, and U.S. authorities, until now, have failed to do anything about it and have failed to stop the system, the offshore system, that facilitates all of this.
And AIG even boasted on its website that it was one of the pioneers in these so-called captive reinsurance companies.
That is right. They invented it, and others have then taken it up, and it continues. It continues. Nobody yet has gone after the Posner scam.
Now, one point I want to stress is that the entire concept of reinsurance makes the insurance industry viable, because with big liabilities such as insuring ocean-going ships with expensive cargoes, no one insurance company could do that. So that the concept of reinsurance is essential to the entire insurance business. But what you're talking about is a whole special kind of business. Now, Lucy, too, most of this has not been covered in the mainstream media, and you've been out front of the pack in basically shedding light on these shady dealings.
Yeah, I tried, a lot of this came into the general problem of Greenberg, what came into the press when his son was shown to have been making crooked deals in order to get accounts. But I had gotten a lot of this information a few years earlier, and there were not any corporate media that were interested in running this, and in fact they're still not interested in running this story. I think it's because it really gets to the structural heart of corruption. It's not done only by AIG, but the structural heart of the corruption is the use of the offshore system, and the corporate media does not want to deal with that.
Yeah, indeed. And one of the things we're going to do, Lucy, we're almost out of time on this side. One of the things we're going to do beginning the second side is to talk about some of the gambits that are used in this offshore consideration in order to basically rip off taxpayers and evade scrutiny. One thing we're going to talk about, too, in side two, Lucy, is an organization that you have put together in order to basically negate the evasion of taxes through offshore mechanisms. Briefly tell us about that and internet contact, and then we're going to sign off here, and then we're going to begin side two.
I've founded this together with colleagues in Europe, and it's called the Tax Justice Network, www.taxjustice.net. It's an organization of NGOs. We're about to establish a U.S. Part of it, Tax Justice USA, which is organizing civil society to fight international tax evasion, which is largely by the corporations and the very rich, and which sucks money from the treasuries both of developing and developed countries.
And people can once again access the internet site for this.
www.taxjustice.net.
TaxJustice.net, and we'll talk about that more inside, too. We have been visiting with Lucy Commissar, investigative journalist and expert on offshore financial evasion mechanisms. We're going to be visiting with Lucy and detailing some more about the world offshore, so to speak, inside, too. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 531. Conversation with Lucy Commissar about offshore, and this is being recorded on October 30th of 2005. Don't forget the Spitfire website and linked websites, a treasure trove of printed information to supplement what you hear on the air. For Lucy Commissar, this is Dave Emery saying thanks for listening.